www.themouthmagazine.com.
A real pleasure on this edition to welcome back one of my favourite previous guests. From Holy Holy, the colleague, friend and fan band who've been paying tribute to David Bowie and kicking up a storm over the last few years. His own pedigree for involvement in Holy Holy is, of course, that he was Bowie's friend and the drummer in The Spiders from Mars, so he was right there in the eye of the cosmic storm as Bowie became Ziggy Stardust. Woody Woodmansey, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here again.
Woody, it's been 3.5 years since we last recorded a podcast together, and in that time, Holy Holy has just gone from strength to strength. Obviously, Bowie casts a long shadow through popular culture anyway, but there's been a lot of attention going his way since his death in 2016. But the rise of this band is absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, hopefully it's not the rise and fall of Holy Holy, you know. Yeah, it's gone really well, you know, and I must admit we haven't had to do much promoting and pushing of it. It's just kind of gone from promoters in different countries. We've done Canada, Japan, two American tours. We just stepped into Europe at the end of last year and did 4 gigs over there. It's a great band, basically. You know, we've stayed true to the songs. And basically the spirit of Bowie's songs, which is, you know, what it's really about. And if you have that understanding of the songs and you want to put them across to people that grew up with them or have just come across those songs, you have to do it right and you have to put it across properly. And we've been able to do that, you know, we've had some great audience responses.
Yeah. I guess, as you say, that's down to the music, the respect paid to the music itself, but also in Holy Holy, I've always felt as this great sense of fun and a real sense of family, actually.
Yeah, it is, actually. It is. It's just one of those strange things where you meet people and it's not an effort to get on with each other. Obviously, we have odd fights here and there, but we can usually say, do you want to dance after an argument? And then we just start we just start doing a waltz around and then it's forgotten, you know. So it's pretty good. And, you know, they're all into it for the music. So I think that's why it works. That, you know, it was only starting doing those Holy Holy gigs like 4 years ago that I had even forgot. My apologies to all the fans out there that didn't forget, but I forgot how good the songs are. And when you're doing a 2-hour show and each one is like, just, you know, playing it, it just brought back so many memories. And because we don't do the theatrics that David did, it's solely on the music and getting it across to an audience for a good night. You're inside the song probably more than I ever was, you know, and you appreciate the amazing ability he had to write songs, you know. He could write a hit on a weekend, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and he probably finished it in the first 20 minutes, but he didn't always want to do that. He didn't always want to write, like, hit songs and play that game of having hit singles. Sometimes he felt like it, sometimes he didn't. But if, you know, like when we finished Ziggy, the record company said, no, we're not releasing it. And, you know, we were like, what? We love this, you know. He said, no, you haven't got a single. So he just went home and over the weekend wrote Starman, you know.
Okay.
And then we went back in and did it. And it was like, yeah, I think that's a single, you know. So just a teeny little bit of pressure if he needed to. And he could just turn it on and write one, you know, which was amazing. He would just say, Woody, I've finished one. And I would be making toast or something in the kitchen. And I'd go in and he'd be sitting there cross-legged. and he'd just play it to me, and I would go, that's good. You know, I got, you know, you weren't going to freak out, because everything he was doing in those days was like, holy, that's another good one. It got to be normal, you know.
Just to set the scene a little bit, back in, I guess, the very late 60s and into 1970, you were playing in bands around Hull. You were well established in that scene.
Yeah.
And in your personal life, you were working. Yet by chance, through Mick,
yeah,
Mick Ronson, came this opportunity to go to London to work with Bowie. Obviously, he had a deal at that point and he'd had a minor success, Space Oddity single.
Yeah.
But it would be very difficult for you to imagine what was to come. So moving down there was actually a real leap of faith.
It was, because I'd only seen a flyer about 7x4 or whatever it was, and it had a bad picture of David with the curly hair from Space Oddity. And I kind of must have heard Space Oddity at some point, but it didn't really grab my attention because I was more into like the hard rock scene. There was no heavy drums on Space Oddity, so it probably didn't impinge on me as it did later on. So I really didn't know what. And I said, I think he's a folk guitarist, Mick, you know. Mick said, yeah, he is, but he's good. But he's writing really good stuff, and we can do really good with him, you know. So it was a culture shock, really. You know, we'd been in the jeans that you didn't wash and a tie-dye T-shirt and bangles and hair to halfway down your back and moccasins, that kind of a look, you know. That was stage wear and street wear, you know what I mean? Dressing up, I might put a bandana on or something, you know, for stage. And Mick was the same, you know. I think he had some Apache, my girlfriend at the time, made him some Apache boots, suede and with tassels hanging off. And he had two wristbands that looked like an Indian chief. So that was the extent of clothes things, you know. So moving down to London, it was a shock from that viewpoint. It was the tail end, I guess, of the Carnaby Street and the British fashion thing and all that. You know, it hadn't really reached Yorkshire, anything new hadn't really reached up north. And I met him, and what he was wearing was the opposite to me, you know. There was just me and him on the first day that I met him. And he had this kind of rainbow T-shirt on. He had long hair, so at least we were similar in one respect, you know. He had a silver belt on, bullet-type belt, red corduroy trousers and blue shoes, and he'd obviously sprayed stars. He had a star on the top of each shoe. They were kind of normal slip-on shoes, but they didn't look normal, as he basically designed them himself and made them, you know. And I just thought, well, you know, because I had this checklist in my head, because I wanted to make the move to London, just because you couldn't really do it from Hull. And I thought, well, the Beatles moved from Liverpool, they had to move, and so it's not really going to happen in Hull. This checklist was like, can he sing? I didn't really know if he could sing, you know. Can he write songs? Does he look cool? Is he intelligent, or is he thick? You know, very big, a very basic list, but it was just what was going through my head, you know. The things I needed to know, I just left a really good job. Even though that wasn't really my thing, it was still a good job. And, you know, he played me some of his older stuff, the more folky stuff, and that didn't really set a fire in my creative heart, shall we say. You know, it was like, love you till Tuesday, whatever, good, yeah, next, you know. Because I still wasn't used to listening to that kind of music, because I'd never listened to it, you know. I'd heard Dylan, and I thought he sounded like Yogi Bear on drugs, you know. So that was an out, that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah. So what songs did he have, perhaps, that encouraged you to make that leap?
He played some tracks, and it was like, okay. And then he picked up his 12-string. And just sat like 5 feet away from me and played Wild Eyed Boy from Free Cloud.
Right, yeah.
And I was just like, it just took me away, basically. And, you know, I had music for me is something that gives you enough for you to paint the picture in your head. You get the story and you're creating a story to the lyrics. And it did that. And I just had, I went, wow, this, he can write. You know what I mean? That, yeah. Just that one song, yeah. Tick the Box. And his voice wasn't Paul Rodgers. It wasn't Roger Daltrey. It wasn't Robert Plant. It wasn't all the singers that I was used to. He didn't have that kind of bluesy edge, but he just, the ability to communicate with his voice just did it. It was like, my God, and he's very English. So I kind of thought immediately, well, this would probably go well in America. It's very English. As I say, he looked good. He looked the part. He was intelligent. We talked through what he'd been doing, mime and a bit of acting and this, that. And I was like, well, he's definitely being an artist 24/7. He's definitely, and you know, because we were, Mick and I, and every band I'd been in, we were kind of semi-pro. We were working and doing it. But this guy was, he wasn't a plumber. You know what I mean? Yeah. He wasn't doing bricklayer jobs to pay the rent. You know what I mean? He was being an artist 24/7, and you could see it. And he was nearly always that 24/7. He was either listening to stuff or watching things or reading magazines, books. He was just soaking up stuff, you know. He seemed to have this amazing ability to take on any art medium, understand it, and then 20 minutes later, he was that, and he was able to do that. He didn't care what it was. If he liked it, right, I want that. I want to understand that. He had this ability to duplicate it.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't care if he was copying. I mean, he wouldn't rip off, but he just had, as the Neil Young said, written that song that he's just played to me. You thought that's like Neil Young, but it's not. It's a John Lennon type thing. And he just had this ability to, he didn't really care who he was being or what he was being. It was the result he was after, the end result. I mean, I remember seeing him in Haddon Hall, and we all lived together in Haddon Hall. And you'd have an Australian guy, artist, would drop in, and in 5 minutes he was talking with an Australian accent. I would think, he's going to get a smack. It's obvious that he's doing it. By the end of it, the guy almost thought he was Australian. You know what I mean? And he wasn't taking the mickey. He was quite willing to be an Australian. He was quite willing to be a dancer. He was quite willing to, whatever it was, he was like, yeah, I'll be that then.
So plugged in to everything around
him. Yeah, yeah. Just, I think most of us walk around being, we're very aware of what we are and what we're not, and what we don't want to be, and what, you know, or what we don't want to be seen as. But he didn't seem to have that. I mean, there were some things I'm sure he wouldn't want to be or emulate. But if it was something that took his fancy and he thought he could use it, then right, I'll have that. And he just picked it up and put it in his kind of mental library. And it came out as David Bowie, you know.
Well, you mentioned Haddon Hall there quite interestingly. And reading your... That was the house that you all shared. And legend has it that time spent there was quite decadent, but reading your autobiography, which came out a couple of years ago, there's also this sort of innocence about it all. Not that you and Trev and Mick were innocents abroad or anything like that, but it seems at that time was quite quaint in a way. It doesn't seem that it was a really heavy scene. It feels like it was a really joyful learning curve, and that period really opened you up as a person.
Yeah, it did. There were a lot of culture shocks, I guess, from different aspects of it. You would get woken up to a dozen models with no clothes on dancing below you, and we were on the balcony, and you'd look down through the banisters, and they were all naked, and you recognised some from TV, and you were like, I think it's time to get up, mate. You know, so I don't know. It was just, I guess we tended to have a northern viewpoint of it all. It was like you were thrown into the mix. You were in the mix, and whatever happened, happened. And you, you observed it and you just let it be whatever it was, you know. So there were wild things that went on. And after a while, when you're in a kind of a scene like that, whether it's the Andy Warhol crowd, that's what you're dealing with. So you tend to take that as normal. It becomes normal. It's no longer a, oh my God, you don't view it like that. It's kind of part of the scene. I mean, when David was doing a photo shoot and he came down the stairs, there was a big staircase. One whole wall was a stained glass window, like in a church, and he walked down in this dress, you know. And he said, what do you think, Woody? How do you answer that? You
bring back the naked girls.
Yeah, yeah. And I went, well, I said, definitely different. I never say it. And he goes, it's a man's dress. I said, yeah, of course it is. And then you have to find your own, what's the word, reality on the thing. And to me, it was like a Renaissance painting, basically. And that kind of sat all right with me. So you were continually finding reasons for this or how it fitted. Some of it didn't fit. I mean, when we finished Man Who Sold the World and he was on the front of the cover in a dress, it was just, okay, it's a heavy album. It's like a hard rock album, but I can't imagine a Led Zeppelin or a Black Sabbath fan with the two, you know, a Sabbath album and a Led Zeppelin album and a Bowie album with the dress on. I can't imagine them walking about London holding them, you know. So it sometimes worked a little bit against, I thought, you know.
Interestingly, in your book again, and you're actually quite a private person, so I don't want to spend too long on this subject because I'm not sure you'll particularly want to talk about it. But but a little later on, you investigate, just thinking about ways of coping with reality, as you were talking about just then. A little later on, you investigated and turned to Scientology, which I've always found interesting, that methodology, those techniques. You actually credit them with making you, well, not a shy person anymore,
yeah.
Which is really, really fascinating because you're right in the middle of this explosion, if you like. The opportunity would be there to be incredibly shy, actually, because you were getting so much attention.
Yeah, it was something I'd learned to deal with. I mean, I just thought, well, that's what I've been dealt with for my life. I'm going to be a shy, reserved kind of person. I was all right on the drums because I had a drum kit in front of me, and I knew my job, and I knew what I was doing, you know. But even then, like, you know, when we did 5 years on Whistle Test, and we'd done one run-through with the cameras, and I knew where the cameras were going to be. And then at the end, they decided the last shots were going to be on me directly, and the camera was coming closer and closer, and it was just agony. they didn't tell me that was going to happen. So it was things like that. I could bluff it. I could get through it. So outside, nobody knew, but inside, it was painful, you know, because you were in lots of, as you say, in the middle of all that extravaganza and that circus, you were having to deal with that as a very shy person, which took some doing so that nobody, it wasn't that apparent, but inside it was painful. And it was something that I thought, okay, well, I have to deal with this for the rest of my life. The bigger it got, I guess, the more of a problem it became, because you had to deal with all aspects of the business, and you put on the spot, you're in front of 500 reporters with cameras, and and it was just excruciating at times. And when Mike Garson joined us as a keyboard player, he was a Scientologist. Now, we were in Phoenix, and he was just chatting to me, I think it was about like is there anything that would make your life better or something? You're doing really well, you're at the top, but... And I said, yeah, if I wasn't so flipping shy, you know. And that is pain. I went through it and he went, well, there's a Scientology course that takes you a couple of weeks and it's designed to help that kind of thing. I honestly didn't think anything would because I'd lived with it for all those years. And I don't know, I just thought, what the heck, you know, give it a shot. It's supposed to do that. I'll give it a shot. And I approached the whole thing, really, as a Yorkshireman. Does it do what it says on the tin? Basically, it was. I didn't even know, okay, it was Scientology, but I didn't even know what that was or what it meant or anything. It was just, okay, this course might help that. If it helps it a teeny bit, then it's obviously going to be better for me. And in 2 weeks, it just handled it. It showed me why I was like that and how not to be like that. And not have anything, no matter what's happening in life or what's in front of you, you can actually face up to it without any adverse effects on you. And to me personally, that was a miracle that I never thought would happen. It just changed me as a person in 2 weeks. And I was like, oh my God, how, you know, and then I went to look, but how did it do that? It was just amazing. And then I looked at what else it did. Other courses, and again, from a very Yorkshire down to earth viewpoint, which in America they thought was a bit, you know, I didn't take any BS. I'd be very blunt about everything, and everything I did what it said, and it just helped me. I guess helped me carve out what kind of a life I actually wanted, as opposed to what you're supposed to have, what people in bands are supposed to be like. How you're supposed to act, you know, you're supposed to throw TVs out the window because then that proves you're a real artist. Do you know what I mean? And none of that kind of stuff really, I mean, some of it appealed, but not a lot of it, you know. So it helped me really see what meant, what was true for me.
Yeah.
It was that. It was what's true for me. I want to do what I want to do and I enjoy that, but how do I want to do it?
So I guess it's about taking control of yourself, really, isn't it? Taking control of yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And not just being successful, but having the kind of success that actually means something to you. And you don't have to compromise your beliefs or your ideals or anything to actually do it. That meant a lot to me, you know. And then I was always into spiritual things anyway. So then, you know, I got into the spiritual aspect of it. And realized that a lot of what I'd been doing was dealing with you as a spiritual being, as opposed to a flesh and blood piece of meat. Do you know what I mean? That puts nice clothes on. You know, it was the spiritual aspect of it, and it's been that ever since, really.
Well, I guess as our time together this time is fast running out, Woody, I have to ask you really. David died in early January 2016, which was obviously a great shock to the world. Holy, we're actually on tour in, I think, Canada with Tony Visconti in the band. Tony had actually produced the Black Star album, which had come out only a couple of days before.
Yeah, yeah. We were actually playing a club or a venue in New York on David's birthday. And when we got to the place, a lot of the staff at the venue said, oh, we think David's coming down. We've had a rumour, you know, to come down and sing with you. And we were like, well, that would be nice, but we haven't heard that rumour. I can't really see that. And he didn't turn up. And then halfway through the concert, Tony said, oh, I'm going to give him a call, you know. So we all got together and he phoned him and he answered. And we were about half a mile from your place playing. We just wanted to ring up and wish you happy birthday. And he said, oh, that's really nice. We played a very bad karaoke version of Happy Birthday as a band, and the audience all sang, and we held the phone up. And he said, oh, that was really cool. Thank you for that. He said, ask the audience what they think to Black Star, because it came out today. You know, they went wild. And he said, oh, thanks for ringing. Good luck with the tour, and I'll catch you later. So for us, it was a real high point. It was right at the start of the tour. And it was just so nice to actually speak with him and that. And then we were in Canada a day and a half later, 5 in the morning, my phone was bouncing around the cupboard, just basically so many emails and whatever. And I thought, oh, we're obviously doing well, you know. And I took ages to actually pick it up, and it was my son. He said, I've just watched the BBC in England, and Bowie's died. And it was 5 a.m, and I was like, what did he say? And he said, David's dead. And I was like, no way, you know. It was just so surreal. You're half asleep. That those words didn't seem real. I got up and I went to Tony, and he just found out as well. So I consoled him for a bit, and then we got all the band up. We went for coffee, and we said, hell, what the hell are we going to do? We're at the start of a tour. Is it disrespectful to carry on? We don't want to be disrespectful. And Tony said, well, David worked right to the end on Black Star, and he was doing the musical at the same time. He just kept going. And I said, well, to be honest, there were times on the Ziggy and Aladdin Sane tours where he wasn't eating and he wasn't that healthy, and he would get pneumonia. And in the morning, he'd say, we're going to have to cancel the gig tonight. There's no way he can perform. And he would go, no, you're not cancelling. And we'd go on, and you could not tell. You could not tell. He would pull off an incredible performance. He would come off and then collapse. In fact, he collapsed during a show in America. And he said, no, it's always whatever's happening, the show must go on. If you said you're going to perform, you have to do it. So we put all that together and said, okay, we got to go on. And then we went on our sites, and there was like 20,000 messages saying, we need to see you. The best way through this will be music. You have to come. Please don't cancel them. We just went, okay, we do it. You know, we didn't know what it was going to be like. And it was different. You know, the first dozen rows were just hugging each other, crying, and Kleenex tissues out, you know. And I had to swear at the audience in the end and say, look, this is not a funeral. This is a celebration of his life and music. So you're supposed to have a good night. That's what he would want, you know. And it was a great tour, but it was very surreal playing those songs after that news. You know, every song took on a different poignancy, really, you know.
I've often wondered, Woody, you know, you didn't work with David after Aladdin Sane, and I've often wondered, actually, whether you met again and spoke again, whether you reconciled.
Yeah, we did. I was doing session work in France when he was doing the Low album. He was in the Chateau in France, anyway, one of those albums. And I hadn't spoken to Tony for a couple of years. I heard that he was in there, so I kept Tony ringing. And he said, oh, look, he rang back 10 minutes later after we chatted and said, David said, why don't you come down and hang out? You know, we're recording. So I went down, and then we went out to dinner, and we just chatted through the whole Spiders from the beginning to Aladdin Sane. And he said, there was a lot going on that wasn't out in the open. And it's made me realize that I'm never going to have that rocket ride again. That meant so much to me, to go from nearly obscurity to a major star. He said that rocket ride and that the feeling we had as the Spiders and Ziggy was I'm never going to get that again. That was special. And it was nice. We kind of made up any arguments we'd had through that period. And then a couple of emails in later years, some business things. So it was sorted, you know what I mean? It was closure.
Great. Okay, Woody, well, the Holy Holy dates are early in 2019, and very, very pleased that that's still a going concern, because it is a fantastic band, and as you say, it's a real celebration of Bowie and of the quality of those songs, really. So look forward to those gigs, and thank you very much once again for your time today, Woody Woodmansey.
My pleasure, Steve. See you later. Thank you.
www.themouthmagazine.com